All right, it appears counsel in the third case are ready. I will call that case now. The third case is case number A24-0107, caption State of Minnesota, Office of the Attorney General, Appellant versus Madison Equities, Inc., respondent. I believe counsel are familiar with our standard procedures. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for a rebuttal argument. Counsel for appellant, you may approach and begin. I'll mention again that our lectern is adjustable. It goes up and down. There's a button on the front, two buttons on the front edge that you can press to either make the lectern go up or down to your to your preference.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jason Plegencool on behalf of the state. It's Plegencuhle. May it please the court, opposing counsel. The Attorney General is empowered to conduct pre-suit investigations and satisfy himself that the law has been violated before bringing to bear the full force and power of the office by filing an enforcement action and seeking to recover equitable remedies to protect the public. This has been recognized as good public policy for decades because it not only permits the AG to vet the voluminous, unsubstantiated complaints it receives, but it also protects businesses and courts from unnecessary litigation if the AG determines, after conducting an investigation, no violations exist.
So can I interrupt just, and I'm sorry for doing this so early in the argument, but in 8.31, subdivision 3, the Attorney General can command suit for an injunction and other relief, and the language is on becoming satisfied that any of those laws has been or is being or is about to be violated. So how do you read that compared to the standards under the rules of civil procedure for commencing a lawsuit? Is the Attorney General becoming satisfied? Is that a higher standard than just plain old, well, I'm not gonna get sanctioned by Rule 11? How are we to read that language, and is it significant? Should we pay any attention to it at all?
It is significant, Your Honor. It's a recognition that of the kind of the role of the office and the amount of complaints the Attorney General received and how best to take in that information and use the enforcement authority of the office in an effective manner. And so the Attorney General is different than other private parties in that it has to satisfy itself violations occur using the pre-investigative authority, the pre-suit authority in 8.31 to do so. So in that way, you know, the Attorney General is different than other private parties. And also, this is because the Attorney General isn't receiving these facts directly. It's not a personally involved party who's itself being harmed. Instead, it's acting on behalf of the public interest and needs to have an opportunity to take in the information, review it, vet it, satisfy itself violations have occurred before it can commence and exercise that enforcement authority.
The theory of tolling that you rely on or rely principally on is what you call pendency tolling. Has that term been used by any court? I mean, that precise term, those two words together in that order?
That was our shorthand moniker for the doctrine, you're first recognized in Holmgren.
You want to coin it, I think. How would you, I mean, if you were asked to, and I'm going to ask you, I guess, to give a one-sentence definition of that doctrine, what would it be?
It would be that the commencement of an action that is related to a determination that must be resolved in order for a claim to be brought tolls the running of the statute of limitation during the pendency of the litigation of that matter, so long as it's litigated to a final judgment.
And that it's, and so what I'm struggling a little bit with is you said related to, and I guess it seems like in those three cases that you've provided, and by the way, are those the only three cases that you were able to find that apply this doctrine?
I think there's at least four or five that recognize it. So Holmgren was the first.
And I'm thinking of precedential cases.
Yeah. What the cases we cited in our briefing are the totality of the cases we're aware of, Your Honor.
Okay. I mean, they arise in a variety of settings. I mean, and in one case it's a separate case but a related case. In another case, it seems like it's the same case. And I'm another case is just unclear about what about. So, but. I guess, can you help me gain some comfort level with the application of this theory to this case? Go ahead.
Happy to, Your Honor. So I think I would point you to the Sherritt case, which is the one we emphasize in our briefing. And that case, I think, is most analogous and instructive to the situation here. And in the Sherritt case, the Court of Appeals held that while a teacher challenged his leave of absence and sought reinstatement to a full-time teaching position, that the limitation of period applicable to any back wages claims that teacher would have had were told because what was litigated there was a related determination that had to be resolved in order for those back wage claims to be brought.
Can you help me understand the factual background in Sherritt, because I didn't understand what this other action was exactly based on our court's opinion.
Our reading of Sherritt is that what was litigated to finality was the reinstatement. And
was it a grievance? What, I mean, do we know from, what was this other proceeding, I guess? I just had trouble trying to figure out exactly what that was, and I think that's a key to how helpful this case is or is not.
I don't think it was a grievance. I'd have to look back at the case, but I believe it was litigation brought challenging the determination of being placed on.
All right, thanks. Okay. All right, go ahead. Sorry, I didn't mean to. Go ahead.
So just like in Sherritt, the what had to be litigated here before the Attorney General could even begin to gather information and satisfy itself that the laws had been violated was the CID litigation. And that was litigated to finality, and the state prevailed in that litigation. And because of that, we think this line of cases that hold kind of determination of a related matter that is required in order to bring that a subsequent claim is directly applicable and why pendency tolling would apply.
As I understand respondents' argument, they're saying, yeah, that's all well and good, and maybe you could have started the Cadillac lawsuit then once you got the information, but you had six security guards, and so why couldn't the Attorney General have started a lawsuit just, in 2019, not long after these security guards came forward with their reports?
So I think that argument really misconstrues the nature and the type of cases the Attorney General brings. The Attorney General wasn't investigating just what happened to the six individuals that came forward. What was alleged, unsubstantiated, but alleged by those individuals was a widespread practice affecting many hourly workers. One of these whistleblowers alleged that the practice extended to non-security guard workers, maintenance workers. And so we had six reports from whistleblowers, four of which provided us no documents, two of which provided us partial payroll pay stub records, but not a complete record. And we had no information about the inner workings of the company, whether or not this kind of web of interrelated companies were operating collectively as a single enterprise. We needed to investigate and determine all these facts, and we were prevented from doing that by the CID litigation. And that is why tolling is so appropriate here.
So I mean, along the lines of Judge Johnson's question, there's not a lot of case law here. So respondent argues this is an issue for the people across the street, the legislature, to add to 8.31 some kind of a tolling provision. And it's really not up to us as the courts to provide that. So what's the response to that? And the only equitable tolling, if you know, there's the pendency tolling that you argued, and then equitable tolling. And are the only cases dealing with equitable tolling, like these fraudulent concealment cases? I mean, how do we get to where you want us to go?
Yeah, so the principle of tolling has long, decades-long roots in Minnesota that the cases we cite indicate. Pendency tolling is one argument we've made. Equitable tolling is separate and distinct from that. That's an error the district court made where it misconstrued the two as being the same. They're separate and distinct if you look at the lines of cases. And equitable tolling exists without independently in the common law without need to be referenced in a statute. And that that's recognized, I think, in the Sanchez case we cite and otherwise. And the principle of equitable tolling is to do justice. And it's recognized, therefore, in circumstances where something outside of the party's control prevents it from being able to meet a statutory deadline, or where the party acts diligently but was prevented from getting vital information about its claims. And we cite cases, the Guerin case, the Oaks case, as well as the Sanchez case is also helpful. All these cases recognize that the equitable tolling doctrine should apply in circumstances just like this, where the state was acting diligently, it diligently litigated this investigation, it diligently tried to investigate, it was prevented from doing so due to an invincible necessity of having to litigate the CID litigation all the way up to the Supreme Court where it prevailed. And then, not only then, after what were state orders lifted and it was able to begin to collect information it needed to be able to satisfy itself laws had been violated.
So if we were to agree with your argument, then what do we apply to say, okay, this is still timely? I think the Attorney General initiated suit, was it within 60 days? I've got it written down in my notes here, of the, was it Supreme Court's order or the district court's entry of final judgment in the case? So is that quick enough? I mean, what are we to be guided by in saying, okay, this is still okay if we go along with the Attorney General's position?
Absolutely. So what you should be guided by is the concept of tolling. So the period of time the state was prevented from being able to investigate and satisfy itself the laws were violated, that period of time should not count towards the running of the limitation period. And so with respect to pendency tolling, our first tolling argument, it's very clear that the period of time that's tolled is the period of time that initial matter is litigated. So up until final judgment, from the date that action was filed up until final judgment, that's the period of time that should not count towards
the
running of the limitation period.
From the motion to quash until final judgment in the CID, you still had however many up to the 2 or 3 year statute after that.
Right, so you'd count from the date we commenced the action back 3 years because we allege willfulness in the complaint, but not count the period of time the action was litigated in the CID litigation. For equitable tolling, it's based more on all the facts and circumstances in the case, but it's that same concept of tolling the period for that period of time the state was unable to act.
So if I may ask one more question, how do we interpret the phrase paramount authority? What does that mean?
It's not clearly defined in the case law. I'd give you that, Your Honor.
It's really not defined at all from what I read.
Yeah, but I think it's other cases. I think it's a matter that prevents a party from otherwise being able to act, and that's exactly what we have in this case. There were actually literal court orders staying our ability to investigate and satisfy ourselves the laws were being violated here.
So it's that duty of the Attorney General before putting the weight of the Office of the Attorney General and the resources in deciding whether to bring suit and then actually bringing suit that you're saying is that is what was being interfered with or delayed during the, because the investigation was delayed by the litigation.
It was correct. It was being thwarted. Our ability to both exercise our statutory ability to investigate, to satisfy ourselves, the laws had been violated. We were completely prevented from doing that while the CID litigation was being litigated.
Mr. Plagiacul, I just have a question. I know you're running out of time or out of time, but I totally understand the principle behind the CID. Are we in a circumstance where the Attorney General, if they are being thwarted in the investigation, has to go forward and just put a matter into suit in order to deal with the statute of limitations problem that developed here?
Well, that's exactly what the Cohn case said is against the public policy of the state.
Right.
In Cohn, it said the state needs to be able to satisfy itself the laws have been violated before it brings suit, and the best and fairest manner for which it can do that is through that pre-suit investigative process. And as a practical matter, that just has to be the case. Our office, last year, we received 17,000 complaints from the public. And if we were expected to not be able to look into those complaints and satisfy ourselves that there's actual violations there, we'd be inundating parties with litigation when maybe those complaints were not meritorious because we didn't have time to look into them, or we'd be burdening the court with many, many complaints. And so that's the whole purpose why the Cohn case recognized this is the public policy of the state for the Attorney General to have this authority.
I have one or two questions. I recognize we're out of time, but so in your view, if let's imagine a hypothetical where there's a CID is served and it's a complex matter, due to no one's fault, it goes on for a number of years. But so there's, you know, responses, there's maybe additional demands, responses. I think this happens from time to time. And then eventually, then the AG brings a lawsuit in court, but it's beyond the statute of limitations. Does the pendency tolling doctrine apply to toll the SOL in that case?
If what was being investigated was, and here this was the case, we noted we're investigating overtime violations in the CID. If what was being investigated was the same matter that was subsequently brought into litigation, then yes, the pendency tolling doctrine should apply for the period of time that there's CID litigation that is preventing any investigation.
I didn't mention a lawsuit.
I'm sorry. I thought you said there was a subsequent lawsuit filed by.
No, there was just a CID response, another round of demands. Response took a while. AG, you know, it's a complex matter. The AG, the office, it requires time to analyze it and before they become satisfied. But if that extends beyond the statute of limitations without any lawsuit, then does the pendency tolling doctrine apply?
Well, Your Honor, if there's no lawsuit, there's nothing to toll. So.
Then the AG sues the target of the CID then commences an action for a violation of law, without any intervening. What I meant was, I'm sorry, maybe I didn't. We didn't make it clear. But there's no litigation concerning the CID. There's no discovery disputes. There's simply The CID process rolls out as it should. It just takes a long time. It takes longer than the statute of limitations. And then the AG is satisfied that there's been a violation and then brings suit. But now we're more than 2 or 3 years past the accrual date. In that situation, does the pendency tolling doctrine apply?
Thank you. Sorry. Yes, I understand now. No, it would not, because the pendency tolling doctrine would require commencement of some intervening litigation related to that the lawsuit later filed, litigated to finality for it to apply. So if a normal course investigation, let's say it takes years for some reason, and no party brings it into litigation, the Attorney General has the power to bring a motion to compel and start a proceeding too, under 8.31. If the Attorney General didn't do that, here it did, then that pendency tolling doctrine wouldn't have applicability.
I'd like to ask one question about the second issue, the second claim, the whistleblower claim. And I'm looking at the text of the statute, 181.932(1). So you're focused on the word penalize, I believe. I mean, would you agree that based on the text of the statute, the action prohibited by the statute, it prohibits penalizing so long as it's penalizing regarding the employee's compensation terms, conditions, location, or privileges of employment?
So I'd answer that in a couple ways, Your Honor. First, I think the court has to put into context the 2013 amendment to the Whistleblower Act in its totality. And what that amendment did was it added a definition of penalize. And
to encompass post-termination conduct.
To two things, really, to both encompass post-termination conduct, but in addition, it codified the standard set out in the Burlington Northern case by the U.S. Supreme Court, which applied to
Title VII
discrimination, anti-retaliation. And if you read the Burlington Northern case, we cite it in our briefing. What Burlington Northern said was some states were following this more restrictive material change in the terms, conditions of employment standard. And Burlington Northern rejected that and said, actually, a broader standard for adverse employment conduct applies in the context of Title VII.
I mean, in Title VII, I mean, these are two different statutes, right? 2000E2 and 2000E3, and the language of 2000E3 has no reference to terms and conditions of employment or the like. Here we have kind of one unified statute about what the employer may not do, and it seems like both, you know, a termination or a failure to hire and penalizing action, both are you know, modified by the same phrase regarding the employee's compensation terms, conditions, et cetera.
Well, I think by the legislature codifying that Burlington Northern standard in the definition of penalized.
But where does it say that? I don't see that in the text of the statute, that we're codifying Burlington Northern.
Well, if you look at the Moore case that we cite, that's a 2019 case from the Court of Appeals. It recognizes that the legislature used essentially the same language as the standard laid out in Burlington Northern. And so the statute itself doesn't say it codifies it, but it nearly quotes verbatim the standard set out in Burlington Northern. And so in Moore, when the court was looking at what needs to take place for that element of a retaliation claim, adverse employment action, it looked and applied the Burlington Northern standard. It didn't apply this materially change in the terms, conditions of employment.
So how does, because the statute does add or penalize, and I'm following the Burlington Northern part, but then it says penalize an employee regarding, as Judge Johnson said, the employee's compensations, terms, conditions, location, or privileges of employment. So how was the defamation action, which was commenced after Mr. Lee had already left employment and related to publication by SEIU of the report made, not the report itself, but the report made to the AG, where does that fit in regarding the employee's compensation terms, conditions, location, or privileges of employment? Or are you arguing that penalized somehow or another isn't modified by that qualifier, if you can follow that question?
So two answers, Your Honor. I think if you look at the Moore case, it recognized the Burlington Northern standard as the one that should be applied. But in any event, even if that's not the case, and you still need to connect it to regarding terms, conditions of employment or compensation,
mm-hmm.
that's satisfied here too. When a former employee is no longer with a company, it still retains the right to any unearned compensation that they receive. So that's...
But there's no... So you're saying the defamation action... Well, okay, explain, because they're claiming we're entitled to overtime pay, so I get that. But you're saying that that's the hook.
The report is we're entitled to overtime pay, and the defamation lawsuit is an attempt to penalize that employee, dissuade them from from supporting or further providing information to the Attorney General about that claim. It's an attempt to penalize him for seeking unearned compensation that he believed he was entitled to, and that's compensation. That's regarding compensation, and so it there is that causal nexus here, even if that language still has any bearing following the adoption of the Burlington Northern language and penalize.
How does it affect compensation in this case? Is that what you said?
Because the defamation lawsuit is dissuading Mr. Lewis from further supporting his cooperation, providing information to the state, information about his entitlement to unearned overtime that he was owed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Plugin-Cool. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, please state your name and your client at the beginning of your argument.
May I please the court? I'm Kelly Haddock, counsel for Madison Equities. I think we got to go back to the plain language of these statutes. I know it gets lost in the briefs, but we got to get back to what the legislature set out as the procedure for the Attorney General to investigate claims. And they want to make new law. It's very clear, as we sit here today. You don't hear them talking about what the statutes actually say. We get confused with all these new theories of pendency tolling and equitable tolling. I think the court's right on. All those cases relate to some sort of fraud and fraudulent concealment. And we just got to get back to what are the facts that led us here? Because I think they're very important. Attorney General issues a civil investigative demand. Both the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court said that civil investigative demand was faulty. No matter what they say about whether they prevailed anywhere, both the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court said it's faulty for various reasons. So when they say they were prevented from litigating these things or prevented from filing a suit, that just simply doesn't exist.
Do you want to encourage the Attorney General from just filing a suit and saying, yeah, and we'll find the facts later? And so my question to you is, if they had initiated suit earlier, wouldn't you have had another argument to try to quash the investigative demand and say, hey, they already followed suit. They have to follow discovery rules in this case. They can't, they've closed off that avenue. Or is there something wrong with that argument?
Yeah, well, even within the civil investigative demand under 8.31, they have to follow discovery rules. It incorporates the Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure.
But wouldn't your client be arguing that the CID is now moot and it can't proceed because they've now chosen they're in court?
Well, sure, but they could perform the exact same discovery in court that they were pursuing through this civil investigative demand.
Well, no, it was broader than on behalf of six security guards. I mean, there were requests about, and as a matter of fact, the Supreme Court ordered that your client had to turn over information about all hourly workers.
Yeah, correct. And they could have continued on with the separate civil investigative demand if they wanted to go on with respect to other companies or other workers. There was nothing that prevented them from saying early on and admitting that my demand that I submitted to Madison Equities and 30 other companies was overbroad, and I didn't have that reasonable basis. They could have said, I'm going to withdraw that, and I'm going to issue a new one that actually complies. We would have said,
but
just
your,
as we...
your client, I mean, in all fairness, your client was arguing that they had no reasonable basis to get anything. Isn't that right?
That's not true. We said there was a reasonable basis with respect to the companies that employed security guards. We always said there was no reasonable basis with respect to...
But their whole theory was a joint employer theory. I mean, that's so they had to get discovery about the other.
Yeah, I guess so we never understood their theory, Judge, quite honestly. But I think, again, going back to what the arguments were, 8.31 is very important because they say we have to go investigate all this stuff. It's an absolute must. But if we read Subdivision 2, 8.31, it says the Attorney General may obtain discovery. It doesn't say they have to. It says that may be obtained without filing
suit.
You're
saying it's not, the CID litigation was not a paramount authority because it's discretionary. I mean, is
that's that, absolute, yeah. That's absolutely okay. Right, Your Honor.
So when you're looking at tolling and statute of limitations, I mean, part of the statute of limitations is really notice. So your client was clearly on notice that they may well be sued over this issue, whether by the Attorney General or by the current or former employees themselves. So was there prejudice? I mean, if we said, yeah, the Attorney General's right, then would your client be prejudiced in any way by the delay? Because that seems to be a consideration, right?
Significantly prejudiced, Your Honor.
Okay.
Because the statute sets out 2 years, right, for a statute of limitations. 8.31 also gives a private litigant the right to challenge a civil investigative demand, which is what we did. We're prejudiced now because now all of a sudden the tolling, now all of a sudden they say everything's tolled. Now we got a 2-year statute of limitations where in this case, we're well beyond, from 2017, we're already in 2024. We're gonna be going on a decade almost if their theory would apply. I mean, I can tell you just from working with this client over this period of time, there's very few people that are even left. The security guards have all, that's all went from Allied Security to a different security company to in-house security. I mean, which is the purpose of why we have statute of limitations. And I think it's even more important here why we don't even get into those equitable tolling or whatever, the pendency tolling, put whatever label on it you have. But if you look at 541.07, the first paragraph says, except for these areas. Everything else is within 2 years. So the legislature was very clear. It didn't say except if the Attorney General. It didn't say except if equitable tolling applies, except if pendency tolling applies. It laid out specifically what could alter this particular time frame. And I did in the brief as well provide the other examples of where tolling, the legislature set out tolling periods where people are insane, underage, et cetera. So the legislature is very clear with all this stuff. And I think that's
Mr. Haydock, if we were to rule in your favor on the tolling issue, I mean, wouldn't that then encourage other companies to make objections to civil investigative demands, you know, engage the court process, which moves slowly, generally, and, you know, I mean, wouldn't it encourage people to file basically discovery lawsuits as a stalling mechanism?
Yeah, it's a good question, Judge. I don't know, but you're still under the rules of civil procedure at that point that you have to have good faith basis to go forward. And I think if a court would make a ruling that the party did not have a good faith basis or was simply stalling for various reasons, then you do probably maybe fall into some of the equitable tolling where you got a party that's doing some things that are not equitable with respect to the overall scenario. We just don't have that here. Because again, Court of Appeals found in our favor, Supreme Court found in our favor with respect to the civil investigative demand.
Well, partially.
Partially, correct.
Partially.
But again, that's I go back to 8.31. The legislature specifically allowed parties that are targets of those.
I'm not questioning that.
Yeah, and to say now a private litigant, just because you issue a challenge, now your statute of limitations is tolled. And instead of 2 years, it could be 3 years, it could be 4 years, it could be 5 years, it could be who knows how many years. That's not what the legislature said. And that's specifically why we say if the Attorney General believes that they need to have some new mechanism to investigate and are concerned about statute of limitations and tolling, that's for the legislature to decide. Right now, the legislature did not give them that power. They have a lot of powers. That's not one that they have. With respect to the second claim, I think your honors were right on. And again, Mr. Lewis voluntarily quit employment before he went to the Attorney General, holding hands with the SEIU representative, and then was distributing flyers. And ultimately, there was a defamation claim that was brought. And that, again, go back to the statute, and Judge, you were right on, where it has to relate to terms of employment.
But it does. You're not contesting that action under the whistleblower statute can be brought by a former employee. I mean, that you're not contesting that, are you?
No, absolutely not. Not contesting that. And I think if we even think about it, too, when I heard the arguments of in response to some of the questions, if an employee leaves and they get sued by the employer for, let's say, some sort of non-solicitation agreement, retaliation under their theory. And we know that's not the case. I mean, former employees get sued all the time, but this statute doesn't come up.
I will also point out this is a Rule 12, a ruling on Rule 12, though. And I think what you're talking about is summary judgment, perhaps, or, you know, an ultimate decision after a trial. So we're talking about Rule 12. How do you respond to the Attorney General's argument that the defamation action, and this is a pleading, so we have to take it at face value, was initiated to chill Mr. Lewis from trying to pursue overtime compensation that he believed he was due?
I don't know if that's exactly in the pleadings. I don't believe it was pled out exactly that way. I think that's what he's saying now.
Well, I'm just looking at, if I may piggyback on the question, because I was going to ask, also going to ask you to respond to your opposing counsel's argument. Looking at Addendum 44, paragraphs 94 and 45, it said Lewis provided the office with documents related to his own pay. Next paragraph, he had publicized his allegation that Madison had not paid his overtime wages. So I guess my question is, if we assume that the regarding the employee's compensation, et cetera, modifies the penalized prohibition, are there allegations in this case that would make out such a claim?
There are none because, again, they need to show an adverse employment action as well, and that's not pled.
That's case law that's commonly used to I'll let you go ahead.
Because what's actually
so,
pled.
Yeah, so the standard under Rule 12 is it possible on any evidence that might be produced consistent with the pleader's theory that they may be entitled to the relief they're seeking? So any evidence, that's the standard. And so the Attorney General's office is saying, wait a minute, this is chilling, and there is, you know, if we find there's an ambiguity, we can look at the legislative history here of the addition of the word penalize into the statute, which does, in fact, reference this U.S. Supreme Court case. So what's your best argument for why, no, under the Rule 12 standard, the Attorney General's office still loses?
181.932 requires of employment. He had no employment at the time that this action was brought.
I thought you said, though, that you weren't contesting that a former employee could bring suit under the whistleblower statute.
As long as it's relating to of employment. And I think we get back to, I think one example would be of that, is if an employer owes an employee some deferred compensation, let's call it. And there's a contract that sets that out. They leave. And the employer then puts that up on the billboard to everybody in the office and says, this is what happens when you quit or when you do certain things. I'm not paying it. I'm ripping it up. That would be more of an example of where we would get to here. Not a case like this where Mr. Lewis, after he voluntarily quits, he starts handing out flyers with the union and all kinds of other things that we don't need to get into for purposes of this. It's an entirely separate matter, which again is why I believe the case law then goes into there has to be an adverse employment action that's taken, and that's the Gee case, the 700 Northwest 2D 548. And here you just don't have that when an employee.
But if I could direct you back to the first issue, and the district court in its Rule 12 order cites an assertion made by the Attorney General's office in the CID litigation. I'm looking at paragraph 7 on addendum page 4.
Yes.
So that's outside the four corners of the complaint. So is this still a proper Rule 12 order? Or should the Attorney General be allowed to supply their own evidence? Because, you know, I assume your client said, wait a minute, there's no reasonable basis for anything here except for, I mean, they were employed by Madison Equities, that's all you get.
Yeah. But I think it's important. There's authority where the courts can look outside of that for certain things
based
or take some judicial notice.
What? Judicial notice? But then is that outside the four corners of Rule 12?
But whether, I would say whether it was Rule 12 or converted into a Rule 56 motion, I think in this circumstance doesn't make any difference. But I'm glad you brought that up because I think it falls right into 8.31 where it says the Attorney General may conduct discovery. Because in this case, the Attorney General, without conducting any discovery, made a determination that they had credible allegations. They had more than enough already at that particular time, just like the district court concluded, to bring their case. Why they chose not to, I don't know the answer to that, and we don't know need to know the answer to that, because the statutes dictate where this case should go. And we ask that this court affirm in totality the district court's order.
Thank you, Mr. Haydak. Mr. Plagenkuhl, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just several points kind of related to the discussion. Just to correct the record, Madison Equities did try to quash the CID in its entirety in the underlying CID litigation. And so I just wanted to correct the record there. With respect to the retaliation claim, Rule 8 does apply to that claim, and this is within a Rule 12 posture here under review by this court. State's position is it certainly pled sufficient facts to satisfy Rule 8 for its retaliation claim, and it specifically alleged that Madison Equities penalized Mr. Lewis by filing the defamation lawsuit against him, and that should be sufficient in and of itself to satisfy Rule 12, and includes that is the adverse employment action here. Also, to correct the record, the Madison Equities did argue below that the retaliation language cannot apply to former employees. And in fact, that's essentially what the district court held as well, that if you're a former employee, nothing can ever be regard to your terms, conditions of employment, because you're no longer employed. It's kind of it's a circular argument that would mean former employees could never assert a claim for retaliation. That is just not correct, given the added definition of penalize and its application to post-termination conduct by the employer. I did also want to just briefly touch on our argument that a six-year limitation period applies to the unique remedies available to the Attorney General under Section 8.31. Section 541.075.
You mean 0.05?
075, I believe. That's the two or three-year limitation period. It uses very precise language about the recovery of wages, overtime, damages, fees, penalties that arise under state laws relating to wage laws. And here, the unique remedies available to the Attorney General arise under 8.31. They're not available to private parties who have an overtime claim. They're uniquely available to the Attorney General.
Why should we consider the remedies that might be sought rather than the cause of action or the theory of relief? I mean, your complaint has two counts. First one is under Chapter 177, second one, whistleblower. I mean, in other words, does the statute of limitations depend upon the relief sought? And if so, what's the authority for that?
The authority is the unique language in 541.075 itself, because it talks about the recovery of certain remedies, wages, liquidated damages that are available under overtime, under the state's labor laws.
Now, I mean, I accept the AG can pursue remedies beyond what the individual might be able to pursue, but why does that change the statute of limitations analysis? I mean, the statute of limitations refers to claim, doesn't refer to... Well, anyway, I think I've asked my question.
Right, but the limiting provision itself in 075 speaks to the recovery of certain remedies, the recovery of wages, overtime, damages, et cetera. And 05 talks more generally about liability created under any statute. And so if the remedies sought do not fit any of those very specifically delineated remedies.
But it's not a liability created under statute 8.31. I mean, the Attorney General can't just say, oh, I don't like what this company did. I mean, it has to tie it to another statute, right, or common law?
That's right. There has to be an underlying provision of law the AG is enforcing. Here, that is 177.25. But the two need to be read together, because to the extent the AG is seeking remedies beyond the recovery of wages, overtime, et cetera, those remedies fall outside of that limiting provision in 075, and the 05 broader language should apply to the recovery of those remedies. And here, injunctive relief, restitution, equitable restitution, these are things that are distinct under case law in Minnesota. We cite the Minnesota School of Business case, for example, that clearly recognizes restitution is an equitable remedy that is distinct from damages. And therefore, it should fall under the 05 six-year limitation period.
Which 541.05 has nine paragraphs, which I don't think your brief identified any particular paragraph. Can you identify that for us now?
It would be two.
Two?
Upon a liability created by statute.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments, both in writing and orally. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.